Now, I know that applause was for our honored speaker, but let me introduce myself. I'm Gerald Wolpin. A few years ago, when I was president of the Federal Bar Council, which is the Bar Association for the lawyers and judges in the Second Circuit of federal courts, I had the honor of awarding the Learned Hand Medal to then Chief Judge of the Southern District of New York, Michael B. Mukasey. That award is given annually to a person who has enhanced the rule of law. And you have to understand the real and practical meaning of that award being given to Michael Mukasey. I would hazard a guess that no one here would be surprised to hear that Federalist Society adherents are not necessarily a large percentage of lawyers in the Second Circuit, composed of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. And because Michael never dissembles, it was then and remains true today, it was known that Michael, how shall I say it, has a conservative tendency and believes in the Constitution as it was written. Yet, Michael was chosen for the award by a large number of lawyers who were diverse in all factors, including politics. Michael had even then I should say that, moreover, from the standing ovation given him by over 1,000 persons present, both before and after his acceptance remarks, in which he minced no words in expressing his views, the Second Circuit Bar as a whole demonstrated its respect for him. Now, this was before Michael's service as Attorney General of this country. It was based on his then already magnificent record as an assistant U.S. attorney, where he served as chief of the official corruption unit, and then 16 years, or 18 years, as a federal district judge, including six as chief judge. Michael had even then a well-deserved reputation of crackerjacks intelligent, combined with hard work and fairness, patience and courtesy, I must say properly tempted by an unwillingness to brook fools and unprepared lawyers, and most certainly as a judge who never strayed from honesty, highest integrity, and the courage to call it as he saw it. Then came his nomination by President Bush to be Attorney General. It appeared at the outset that given Michael's recognized qualities, the confirmation should be a breeze. Indeed, in answer to questions, he underlined his independence and integrity by stating unequivocally that, and I quote, if the president proposed a course of conduct that was in violation of the Constitution, I would either talk him out of it or leave, unquote. But what happened next showed his unwillingness to allow personal benefit to overcome his principles. Some senators asserted they would be conditioning their vote on the nominee's agreement that it would be illegal if the president ordered telephonic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes outside of the procedures Congress enacted in the FISA statute. Michael Mukasey, demonstrating the same integrity and independence he promised to apply to an illegal position voiced by the president, refused to seek confirmation votes by bowing to the senator's erroneous view of the law. He was steadfast in responding that, and I quote, the statute can't change the Constitution, which vests in the president the authority to defend the country, unquote. The rest is, of course, his history. Michael Mukasey was confirmed. He brought to the Department of Justice great leadership. As I personally know, he raised the morale of justice professionals to new heights and provided this country and the president with the best legal expertise and direction. Now, before I give the podium to this great public servant, I must acknowledge his wonderful partner, who for these many years has shared her husband unselfishly with the American people, Susan Mukasey, who is standing in front. Would you stand? And now I have the pleasure to give the podium, call him what you will, Judge or General Mukasey, a great public servant.
I want to thank my good friend Jerry Wolpin, and it's obvious from that introduction that he is my good friend, for that introduction, which was generous to the point of lavishness. I also want to thank him for being a stalwart in his own right. As I'm sure many of you know, Jerry served as an inspector general until he was not only unceremoniously, but on any reasonable view of the law, unlawfully removed from that position, something he has chosen not to suffer, but rather to fight, as he usually does, against injustice. At considerable expense to himself, but I would add with the support of his friends. I also want to thank Gene Meyer for inviting me to this podium. A couple of weeks ago, he told me, actually rather casually, that this time slot had opened up because of a panel on a topic that he didn't mention. I don't know what that topic was or whether there was such a panel. he said that it had to be canceled for a reason that he didn't explain. And asked whether I would be willing to come and say a few words. And so since I've been to conferences of this sort and I've seen what happens when people break out into panels, I figured we'd be in a small conference room and I'd be delivering some appropriately modest remarks to a relatively small audience. The format and venue for these comments has changed somewhat over time. I came yesterday to another event in the Grand Ballroom and realized that this was not going to be exactly what I expected. And of course, events, including events this morning, have overtaken this presentation to a certain extent. And so I will, I suppose, apologize in advance if these remarks have a certain improvisational quality to them. But I think it would be a mistake for me to approach a podium here and not mention what happened this morning, notwithstanding the lack of a whole lot of time to prepare. In spite of that, I think it would be fitting for me to return to where I left off last year. or at least to that part of the performance that was done in a vertical position. When I discussed national issue securities and concerns, and had actually gotten to the next to the last paragraph of my speech, where I expressed the hope that what was then the administration in formation would take a good look at what the outgoing administration had done in good faith to keep this country safe, and would conclude that those measures were both lawful and effective and would by and large keep in place the programs and policies that had succeeded in protecting the security of this country for 8 years. What I had thought to do this afternoon was to examine briefly a few programs, policies, and issues that have been in place since this administration took office to see to what extent that last hope that I expressed was realized, and to what extent not. And I had thought to start with the positive, the instances in which wishes were fulfilled, and then proceed to the instances in which they were not. As I say, that was before the announcement this morning that the administration intends to bring to this country several detainees, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, the architect and principal operative, respectively, in carrying out the September 11, 2001 attacks on this country, and to try them in a civilian court, in fact, in the court in which I used to sit, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, and to bring as well another group headed by a man named Nashiri, and to try them in a military commission stateside at a place that's yet undisclosed. I still plan to follow, to a certain extent, the format that I had intended to follow and to start with some positive news, but obviously I want to deal with some extent with the decision to bring these detainees here, a decision that I consider to be not only unwise, but in fact based on a refusal to face the fact that what we are involved with here is a war with people who follow a religiously based ideology that calls on them to kill us, and to return instead to the mindset that prevailed before September 11, 2001, that acts like the first World Trade Center bombing, the bombing of our embassies in East Africa, and other such acts can and should be treated as conventional crimes and tried in conventional courts. But first, the good news that I promised you. The first category has to do with intelligence gathering. Although there was actually an incipient move in Congress to repeal the authorities that were put in place under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, amendments that were passed in 2008, that appears to have been beaten back. And intelligence gathering authorities have remained in place. To what extent they're being used and how is something I obviously can't speak to now because I'm not privy to that, and even if I were, considerations of security would not permit me that to be discussed in a forum like this. However, I can tell you, based on a report from somebody who was there, that at a meeting between representatives of the Department of Homeland Security and foreign security officials to discuss how the current procedure for tracing money transfers through what is known as the SWIFT system, which monitors international money transfers, was described to those foreign officials, their reaction was that the procedure was the same as the one that had been in place under the prior administration. The U.S. Homeland Security official who was present agreed and pointed out that this was continuity that you can believe in. Now, that is actually reassuring for two reasons. The first, of course, is the continuity, that the program is still working. And the second is that there is somebody at Homeland Security who has a sense of humor. The same appears to be true, at least for the moment, as to procedures that were in place that we at the department put in place to allow the FBI intelligence gathering to continue and to be subsumed into its already existing crime-solving functions. We put those procedures into effect in December 2008, well after well over a year of consideration and review, and despite pressures to roll back those procedures, they have been left in place, at least for the moment, and the Department of Justice has indicated that it intends to allow them to work for a reasonable time before making any changes. All in all, an encouraging, if not surprising, conclusion. And finally, the administration has said that it will continue to recognize the state secrets privilege when litigation threatens to disclose national security information and to bring such litigation to an end, even when the government is not a party to it. The administration professes to have a somewhat narrower view of that privilege than we did, but nonetheless, it's in place. However, when it comes to dealing with detainees and with those in our own government who've been involved in intelligence gathering, and of course, when it comes to the events of today, I think the record is less encouraging. Beginning with the detention and apprehension of prisoners on the battlefield, proceeding through obtaining intelligence from those who may be in possession of it, prosecuting those who can be charged with war crimes, and detaining those who may not be chargeable with war crimes, but who nonetheless were captured while engaged in combat with U.S. and allied troops who may very well target civilians, who do not wear uniforms or follow any recognized chain of command, and who therefore can be detained at a minimum as unlawful combatants and obviously are much too dangerous to release. Here again, the plan seems to be to abandon the view that we are involved in a war and to apply procedures appropriate to a war, which is the view that was adopted after September 11, and to return instead to a September 10, 2001 criminal justice model of the sort that prevailed in the 90s, when we had the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the bombing of our armed forces facility at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, the attack on the USS Cole that killed 17 sailors, the attempt to attack another destroyer called the Sullivan that would have succeeded but for the fact that the boat carrying the explosives sank, both of those, the successful one and the unsuccessful one, having been orchestrated by Mr. Nashiri. The bombing of our embassies in East Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania, and eventually the attack on September 11, 2001 that killed almost 3,000 people. That all of that seems to have followed sweeping proclamations, that is, that change of attitude, announced in January 2009, that implicitly, at least, suggested that the prior administration had sanctioned torture and had been bent on detaining detainees at Guantanamo without proper treatment or access to legal proceedings. The pronouncements were that we would abandon harsh interrogation techniques, which were loosely characterized as torture, and would close the detention facility at Guantanamo within a year. What's followed has seemed in many instances to be a system in which policy is fashioned to fit antecedent rhetoric rather than being thought out in advance with arguments then formulated in support of it. With respect to interrogations carried on in the past, because of the at least implicit suggestion that the prior administration had sanctioned torture, the Department of Justice pressed the argument successfully that previously classified memoranda that described the limits of coercive questioning that trained CIA personnel could engage in should be revealed, along with the legal reasoning underlying how those limits are set, should be disclosed, with the result that our enemies are now to be made aware, or are now aware, of precisely the legal and factual limits of how they can be treated if captured, and to train accordingly, as they did before, using the Army Field Manual, which described less coercive techniques that can be used by soldiers in the field and was generally available on the Internet. When he was a candidate, the president was quoted as saying that it would be absurd to contemplate that Miranda warnings to those captured on the battlefield would be given, but the armed forces have been directed to provide such warnings to those captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan. In addition, cases involving claims that CIA personnel acted unlawfully in the course of interrogating prisoners, which were reviewed by career prosecutors in the Justice Department and found insufficient to justify prosecution, except for one case against a contractor that was in fact prosecuted, and the subjects of those investigations were so notified at the time, are now being reviewed again, even though the determinations in those cases were fact-specific. There is no claim that new facts have been developed, and from all reports, the Attorney General who directed that second review take place did not himself read the prosecutive memoranda that were drafted after the first review and that explained why the decision not to prosecute was made. And of course, there has been this morning's disclosure that the government intends to bring to the United States several defendants charged with planning and participating in the September 11, 2001 attack for trial in the U.S. District Court in New York, including the self-proclaimed mastermind of that attack, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as well as a principal organizer of the operation, Ramzi bin al-Shib. In addition, as I said, another detainee named Nashiri and others associated with him, I believe three or four others, are to be brought here and tried in military courts. You may recall that President Bush attempted by executive order to authorize military commissions to try these and other terrorists, and the Supreme Court said he could not do so absent congressional authorization. So Congress passed the Military Commissions Act to provide that authorization. Thus, the military commissions are fully authorized by law, and indeed, the trials were to have already begun. You may recall that colleague Sheikh Mohammed and others attempted to plead guilty and to achieve their martyr's reward during one of their appearances before that military tribunal that was supposed to have begun to try them. But now that procedure is to be short-circuited, actually long-circuited, we'd be more accurate, so that they can be brought to this country and tried in a civilian court. We should all be aware that those cases, which were scheduled already to have begun, will now have to start from scratch with the filing of indictments, the customary motions addressed to them, and the like. Whether Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will duplicate the demand here that he be permitted to plead guilty to what he has already boasted on several occasions that he did, including on Al Jazeera and in a letter to his wife, of course, I don't know whether he will or not. But if not, of course, he can avail himself of the full array of procedural steps, including discovery and public presentation of evidence that can turn a criminal proceeding into both a cornucopia of information for those still at large and a circus for those in custody. I would remind you that the Moussaoui case, in which the defendant, the so-called 20th hijacker, in which the defendant pleaded guilty, took about a year in the trial phase and 4 years from beginning to end, with the defendant acting out and using the courtroom as a forum for his views. And that, again, was a case in which he pleaded guilty. The tribunal and the facility at Guantanamo were put together with the explicit purpose of handling trials involving classified information and the presentation of evidence of that kind in controlled circumstances, along with rules of evidence that have as the touchstone for admissibility whether the evidence is reliable and relevant, not whether it conforms to all of the requirements of the federal rules of evidence. You should recall that unlike the case of a man named Ahmad Galani, who was recently brought here from Guantanamo to stand trial in the embassy bombings case, the cases against these defendants, whose arrival here was announced today, were not investigated, nor was evidence gathered on the assumption that they would be presented in a federal court with evidence and witnesses secured in the manner that they have to be secured in order for presentation in a federal court. That's only a hint of the difficulties presented by this step, without even touching on the security issues that would be raised by trying to confine and try prisoners who present risks of the sort presented by prisoners like this, including security for the courthouses and jails involved, security for the judge and jurors involved, and the like. This step appears to have resulted simply from a commitment to close Guantanamo within a year, because regardless of the reality on the ground, it has a poor image, along with a desire to exceed what the law requires in order to show the world that we can do not only what the law requires, but more. That a military trial at Guantanamo, a facility that I have visited and that is actually less harsh than most medium security facilities in this country, forget maximum security facilities, that such a trial might actually be seen by the American public and the rest of the world as both fair and successful appears not to have occurred to anyone in authority. In a book that I've recommended in the past and will recommend again called The Terror Presidency, Jack Goldsmith, who served in the Office of Legal Counsel, describes what he calls cycles of aggression and timidity that have beset the intelligence community, beginning with Watergate, followed by the Church Committee hearings, followed by a pullback and the resulting criticism of excessive timidity during the Cold War, followed by Iran-Contra, followed by another period of pullback and demoralization, followed by criticism after the September 11, 2001 attack of a failure to be sufficiently aggressive, a failure to both collect and connect the proverbial dots. We now appear to be in a cycle where the pendulum appears to have swung yet again in the other direction, and with a willingness to disclose the limits of how we gather intelligence and to risk that defendants will turn legal processes into a source of intelligence for themselves and to a forum for expressing their views. If I thought that I or my family or my fellow citizens had three lives to live, I suppose I could be persuaded that we should live one of them as a social experiment to see whether the result here is one that we want to live with. But I don't, and they don't, and you don't. It would take a whole lot more credulousness than I have available to be optimistic about the outcome of this latest experiment. And with that, I'll be happy to take questions. There are two microphones, one near the front, one in the back, and I was urged as a due process matter to alternate between the microphones. I don't know that that's carrying that concept a little far. Sir.
Thank you, General, and enjoyed your speech very much. This morning, former Mayor Koch of New York, someone you're acquainted with, said that New Yorkers should not worry about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others being detained because the Manhattan Detention Center is a very secure place and that he trusts the judgment of the Attorney General sending the prisoners there totally. Your reaction to the his point about the detention center itself, is it safe?
Yeah, the MCC is a very secure place. All that shows is that if you ask the wrong question, you're sure to get the wrong answer. Is it secure? Of course it's secure. They're not going to escape. The question, the question is not whether they're going to escape. The question is whether that is going to be then that not only that particular facility, but the city in the large, will then become the focus for mischief in the form of murder by adherents of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Whether this raises the odds that it will, and I would suggest to you that it raises them very high. It is also whether the proceeding, even assuming that it goes forward within the lifetime of everybody in this room, is one where confidential information is able to be kept confidential and where a trial is able to proceed in an orderly fashion.
Do you have any, and obviously it's impossible to do accurately, but do you have any forecast or thought as to where some of this is likely to lead in the next few years? I'll leave the question there.
Do I have any prediction about where this is likely to lead in the next few years? There was a famous legal philosopher and former New York Yankees catcher named Yogi Berra, who said, I never make predictions, especially about the future. All I can tell you is that for the reasons that I've referred to, I can't see anything good coming out of this. I certainly can't see anything good coming out of it very quickly. And I think it would have been far preferable to have tried these cases in the venue that Congress created for trying them and where they were about to be tried. Yes.
What is your view on the enemy combatant standard? Do you think that should remain the viable legal standard, or do you think perhaps we need another paradigm, you know, to be created to deal with these type of individuals in the war on terror?
Well, if the enemy combatant standard is applied as it has been applied, or as it was traditionally applied before the modern day, then it should be adequate to the task. I should, just to take a couple of steps back, several steps back in history, some of you may be aware that in, I believe, 1943, a group of German soldiers, well, actually two groups of German soldiers, landed off Long Island, one group, and off Florida, another, and landed with the intent of committing sabotage. Interestingly, notwithstanding that the landing is the most vulnerable part of any operation like that, the insertion is the most vulnerable part, they landed in uniform. And they buried their uniforms on the beach. And I would suggest to you that the reason they did that was that they very well knew that if they were apprehended at that point in the operation, the only basis they would have for claiming POW status rather than unlawful combatant status was the fact that they were in uniform and followed a recognized chain of command and at least could argue that they should be detained rather than executed. As it happens, when they were picked up, they were in civvies. And they were tried, convicted. They were tried on direct order of President Roosevelt before a military commission sitting in the United States, convicted, executed and their appeals heard within 3 months. Indeed, the opinion in the case, ex parte querend, was issued after they were already deceased. We're not that quick today. Yes.
General, as I understand it, at the end of your term, the policy of the Justice Department in matters involving foreign intelligence was to gather intelligence against the threat rather than necessarily against particular individuals who may be part of the threat. If the current administration is reversing that and going back to the law enforcement model, do you foresee that they're going to expressly change that intelligence gathering policy as well?
Well, I'm having a hard time with the concept of gathering intelligence against a threat as opposed to particular individuals. There are always particular individuals involved. When you listen to a conversation, it's a conversation between people. And generally, you have a reason for believing that one or both is engaged in activity that threatens the security of the country. Otherwise, given the relatively small devoted to this effort, it would be a colossal waste of time to listen to anything else. So I think that they continue to gather intelligence against the threat. The question is, what, if anything, they do with it? Yes?
Judge, in your practical view, how do you think the court would manage the voir dire process to find a jury that A, is fair and unbiased in the Southern District of New York, and B, hadn't had any news coverage of these particular individuals?
As it happens, I did it in a case involving a trial relating to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And that part, actually, isn't all that difficult, provided that the standards are followed. They don't have to have been comatose for the last 10 years in order to serve on a jury or never to have heard of the case. What they have to be able to do is to promise that they will decide the case based only on the evidence presented in the courtroom and not what they hear on the outside. And there has to be good reason to believe that they will fulfill that promise. And jurors like that can be found. That part of the process, I have great faith in. It's the rest of it that worries me. Yes?
Judge, I believe it's John Derbyshire who's just come out with a book reminding us conservatives that we need to remain gloomy and dismal. And I assure you that I try to follow that advice.
Easier some days than others.
And some administrations than others. In all seriousness, what advice, hope, or counsel can you give those of us who become increasingly dismayed at what we see coming out of the current administration in what truly is an existential fight for the future of this country and the Western way of life?
Look, I think articulating what your eyes and ears tell you and what your common sense tells you is the best and only way to fight fair. If you do it against people who are making an argument that is based on a refusal to face facts, and then you're likely to prevail. I say you. I should add that one of the benefits of leaving public service is that I got to become a member of this organization. So I should say we rather than you. And I want to hasten to add, I don't mean to criticize public servants, including judges, who are in fact members of this organization. I just felt uncomfortable belonging to it when I was on the bench and when I was Attorney General, and so I didn't. But great to be here. I should add also that if I had to be in any venue today after what was announced this morning, I'm glad it's this one.
General Mukasey, could you speak to the decision whether it's defensible to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the Southern District of New York versus the choice of the Eastern District of Virginia, which obviously Zacharias Moussaoui was tried in for the same conspiracy, versus the Western District of Pennsylvania, and the differing jury pools you might get there, as well as the courtroom facilities?
I understand I'm a partisan of the Southern District of New York. I know of no jurisdiction where you can get people who are better prepared to deal with it, and that includes prosecutors, judges, and jurors. I am not aware of precisely enough of the facilities in the Eastern District of Virginia or is it the Middle District of Pennsylvania or the Western? I'm not sure. Right. But enough to make a comparison. But saying that if you have to do it any place, it's a good place to do it. Yes, there's venue in all three places. Saying that if you have to do it any place, that is a place to do it, is not the same by any means and shouldn't be construed by anybody as my saying that that's what I think should be done, because obviously it isn't. Yes?
Judge, what do you think this means for the military commissions going forward? Because it seemed like for a while that the president was interested in using the military commissions, and now is he signaling that he won't use them now?
If I had the gift of clairvoyance, which I don't, I could answer that, although I don't know that even if I could discern the intent now, that it would be the same as the intent as announced before or the intent as it will appear tomorrow. My speech, as I said, had a certain improvisational quality. I think that the policies that have been announced and adopted with regard to what we've been talking about also have a certain improvisational quality.
Judge, this morning, Attorney General Holder responded to a question about whether this opens the door now for these cases being thrown out on a procedural technicality, and either with defects in evidence or the procedure itself. And Attorney General Holder's response was basically that we shouldn't worry about that because he's seen things we haven't seen, and that's just not going to happen. I was wondering if you could comment a bit on whether that's an appropriate answer given the severity of the charges here, and whether we should be really, in a time that people are questioning whether or not they like this evidence at all, especially people in the current administration, we should trust their judgment that this is just going to be okay.
Well, I don't know what he's seen, so I can't very well respond to his level of confidence. I have been a judge, and I'm more to the point, I've spoken to a whole lot of other judges, and betting the farm on the outcome of that process is always involves a risk. The Speedy Trial Act, which applies to Mr. Galani, who was indicted, I believe back in the 90s, if not 2000, is going to interfere to some extent. I mean, there's already a motion to dismiss based on a Speedy Trial Act violation. Now, whether the remedy here would be outright dismissal or simply permission to the government to bring the charges again because of something that is seen as an overriding circumstance, I can't tell you. But it is one government, and he was in custody at least since 2004. This is 5 years later. The period of time provided for in the Speedy Trial Act is 90 days, less excludable time. There are going to be legal problems. I don't know whether the same will hold true with respect to, that is, the Speedy Trial Act issues, will hold true with respect to those who have not yet been indicted in connection with, that is, in the civilian courts in connection with the Trade Center bombing. But I suppose I could see an argument that says that, look, we were charged before a military commission in Guantanamo with that. It's one government, and we were entitled to a speedy trial. Yes?
Judge, I have a question about the finality of this morning's decision. Considering how long this may take, hypothetically speaking, if there were a change in administration in 3 years, acknowledging that double jeopardy attaches probably when the jury is impaneled, is there a way that this decision might not be final, that these cases could be sent back to a military court?
Well, there are two complications with this morning. As I heard reference to, although I've not seen myself, I'm simply reporting, this is straight hearsay, that there is in fact a statute that requires notification of Congress 45 days before folks like this are brought over so that they can do something in response. I don't know whether that's the case. If it is and whether they're going to do anything in response, I don't know. But the question of the government's, not the government's, but the question of what rights aliens have when in custody of the U.S. government is one that is at the least unsettled under the law. But the degree of contact between the alien and the United States has a whole lot to do with it. That's why there was such an effort made to keep out those who were coming in after the Mariel, the release of prisoners from Mariel took place, because once they set foot on American shores, they have rights that they did not have before. If these people are brought here, notwithstanding that they're brought here against their will, the likelihood of it being very easy to send them then back to another area that is remote, secure, and humane, it seems to me is open to question. So it ain't going to be that easy. Yes?
General, what do you make of the critique that some enemy combatants held in Guantanamo are not actually enemies of the United States, but maybe enemies of factional interests in Afghanistan, that some warlords in Afghanistan are simply picking up their factional enemies and declaring them enemy combatants to the United States?
Nobody is in favor of holding people who were simply picked up and turned over on the basis of somebody settling a score. And I favored, before I went to Washington, and I favored after I got to Washington, a robust procedure for separating out people who didn't belong there from people who did. That said, if people have trained in a terrorist training camp, as the people, virtually all of the people at Guantanamo have, I don't know that they're subject to quite that objection. Yes?
Judge Mukasey, your comments on the Speedy Trial Act give rise to a concern that has been expressed by many, that in trying these particular people in Article III courts, we may actually, in order to get convictions, compromise the law that we have for ordinary criminal proceedings. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, that's a real concern, and it applies not only to the Speedy Trial Act, but also to rules of evidence and to a whole lot of other protections. There is a certain hydraulic pressure that's applied in cases like this that tends at times to distort rules when the stakes are very high. And if those pressures are brought to bear here, the law that's created is going to be a law that's applicable straight across the board in all criminal cases, and it could do a whole lot of damage. In other words, once the rules are created here, it's nearly impossible to confine them solely to terrorist cases, whereas obviously to the contrary, that's not true in military commissions.
General, is it true that if something less than capital murder charges are brought or they plead to a lesser charge and these defendants serve a number of years, that when they're released, if they can't be deported, they could be released into this country?
Well, I suppose it's conceivable that they could be deported. It's also conceivable that they could not. And I wouldn't want to gamble on that. Secondly, to the extent that they are within the prisons, they are a threat there as well. Each of these people would be virtually a totemic figure in a prison. And I've heard it suggested that, well, we can keep them in solitary confinement and not allow them to be exposed to the other prisoners. Mr. Reed, who is serving, remember the shoe bomber? He's out in Florence, Colorado. He was in solitary confinement and challenged what are called the special administrative measures that had him in solitary confinement. The administration chose not to contest that, and so he's now free as he wanted to worship and to meet with his fellow prisoners, as others may very well be if they are similarly confined.
Thank you, Judge, and I must say that he has again shown his great service to America, even though he no longer has an official position, by expressing these views so that all can hear him and hopefully people will follow them. We owe him a great debt, and let's give him a great round of applause.